Okay. Well, I've got that. It's time to start. I've got 201. So I'd like to thank all of you for coming to this February 2025 Gold Q&A. I enjoy doing these Gold Q&As. I was just telling my wife, Sarah, that one of the reasons I really like them is because they're virtually no work. It's like, that's good. And so, like, you know, when I'm doing a podcast or like doing a course or something, you got to like prepare. And for these are, you know, I get really interesting questions on these things. And there are, sometimes there are things I had to look up. I had to look up a couple of things, but normally when I have something to look up, it's something I think I ought to remember anyway. And so it's a good thing for me. And so, but they're always good questions. And as usual, I'm not going to be able to get to them all because there's at least twice as many questions here as I can possibly cover. I'll go for an hour, probably till 2 o'clock or so. If you do ask questions in the future, whether you're here live right now, or if you're if you're listening to this later, I tend to answer questions I tend not to answer questions that are really long. And it's just that it takes so much time to read the question, and often it takes a while to explain the question because the long questions tend to be more complicated, that the shorter questions are ones that I tend to go for. So just for your future reference. I also tend to go for ones that I can answer. So if I don't answer yours, it's probably because I have no idea. So, okay. So I'll just go through this list. Number one is, this person asked, besides writing in the sand and the letter to the king of Edessa, why didn't Jesus write his own gospel? Good question. Why didn't Jesus write a gospel? And he's saying, this person, whoever is saying that the only accounts we have of Jesus writing are is writing on the ground and is writing to the king of Edessa. So a couple things about that. The writing on the ground, it actually doesn't say he's writing in the sand. I think it says that he's writing on the ground. That's in the story of Jesus and the woman taken in adultery. That's in John 7 and 8 in some Bibles. But it's that passage that most scholars are absolutely convinced was not original to John. It's a later addition to John. There's not a lot of debate about that among scholars these days because the manuscript tradition is pretty clear. It wasn't originally there. And there are other problems with that show that it's a later scribal addition, as interesting and powerful a story as it is. But Jesus, when this woman is accused of adultery, Jesus stoops down and writes on the ground, and he says to the Jewish leaders who have accused her, let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. And by the time he's done writing, they've all left. And so he doesn't have to accuse her either. So there's that. And it actually says, by the way, that he's writing. It's not saying that he's doodling or drawing or something. It uses the word katagrapho, which means to write, like with letters. So there's that, which was not originally in the New Testament. The person asked about the king of Edessa, and that's E-D-E-S-S-A. This is a city in Syria. And we do have an apocryphal account of Jesus having a correspondence with a king named Abgar, who was the king of the city of Edessa, a large city that had a Christian, eventually had a Christian population. And it's a terrific little exchange of letters because the king of Edessa, named Abgar, is very ill and he wants Jesus to come heal him. And so he writes him a letter during Jesus' ministry, and Jesus writes him back and says, sorry, I can't come. I've got other things I need to do. It means he has to go off to be crucified in Jerusalem. He can't, you know, he's on the way to the cross. And so, but he promises that he'll send a disciple after he dies. And in the story, then he does that and converts the entire city of Edessa. And it's one of these feel-good Christian stories about the mission. It's allegedly a writing by Jesus. We actually have one other alleged writing by Jesus that is even less known among the population at large. I dare say that there's not probably one out of 100 scholars of the New Testament who know about this one. If you know any, ask them if they know about this. It's in a book that like nobody reads. It's called The Narrative of Joseph of Arimathea. It's an apocryphal gospel that is usually combined with the other books that are called the Pilate Gospels. So they're telling the stories of Jesus from other perspectives, especially that of Pontius Pilate. This one is Joseph of Arimathea. Jesus on the cross here in this account, one of the robbers tells Jesus that he'd like him to be remembered when Jesus comes into his kingdom. And Jesus says, as in Luke, truly this day I'll be with you in paradise. But he has to, get this guy into paradise, and you got these cherubim who are guarding the gates. And so Jesus writes a letter to the cherubim, these angelic figures who are protecting heaven from invaders. And he writes them, and Jesus writes this letter from the cross to the cherubim. Dear cherubim, this person, I'm sending him with my authorization. Please let him in. And so you get this account. And since he's nailed to the cross, you've got to assume he's dictating this letter to somebody who's writing it and sending it to the cherubim. I don't know. But so those are the only three instances that I know of. They're all apocryphal of Jesus writing. And the question is, why didn't he write his own gospel? I think there are a number of reasons. One is, I don't think he could write. I'd say that even in the gospels, there's no indication in the gospels that Jesus could write. He only said to read in one passage, Luke chapter 4. I think another reason he wouldn't have written his own gospel is because Jesus thought that the end of the age was coming soon. He didn't think that things would be around for another few thousand years, and so he would have had no reason to write his gospel. He was converting people there and then. Okay, good. All right, number two, another interesting question, completely different. In Genesis chapter 1, what light is the author likely referring to in the phrase Elohim speaks that is generally translated, let there be light? Okay, Genesis 1, you have the creation story set out over 6 days. There are 10 acts of creation, but the author divides the 10 acts of creation into 6 days, and then on the seventh day, God rests. But the first thing that happens in creation is God says, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that it was good. The question is asking, what was this light? And I think the reason the person's asking the question, I don't know because they didn't indicate this, but I think the reason they're asking this is because it's not until day 4 that you get the sun, the moon, and the stars. And so where's the light coming from? What's the source of light? And before the sun, moon, and stars, the earth is created, and plants are created. So there are plants on earth before there's a sun. So without photosynthesis, how does that work exactly? I don't know. But the question is, what's the light? And so there are two approaches to this that I frequently hear. The approach by those who are Bible believers would say it's Bible believers who are kind of more in the liberal mode is that it's the Big Bang, right? And that it's all of a sudden you have light. And so it's before you have the sun, moon, and stars. Fair enough. Okay, good, right? The other explanation, I don't think this author knew about a Big Bang. I think that probably he simply hadn't kind of put it all together, that you can't have plants without a sun. And you can't really have a light without a source of light. And it's not unusual in this account to have these kinds of internal tensions. It's actually kind of what happens. And it happens when you compare Genesis 1 with Genesis 2, you have these discrepancies. And I think that these authors were not just, they weren't trying to be scientists, trying to work it out. They had religious reasons for the way they did it. And the religious reasons for what's going on in Genesis 1 is that there's a progression within creation. That first you get light, then you get a firmament that divides the water above from the water below. God does not create water. The water is there. What God does is he creates a space between the water above and water below so that this is where the earth is. The water above is why it rains. There are holes in the sky sometimes and it rains. And it's why you get springs and fountains of water from underneath, because there's water underneath too. And so he's explaining this progression. So you have that, and then you get the firmament, then you get plants, then you get animals, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so I don't think the author really thought clearly through how you can have light without a source of light. Just my view. All right, next question. Has scholarship advanced on the Gospel of Judas since you wrote your book in 2006? Anything you've changed your mind on since then? So, yeah, 2006, I wrote my book, The Lost Gospel of Judas Iscariot. The gospel became public news 2 years before that. I think it was in 2004 when there was a big press conference in Washington, D.C. announcing the discovery and the soon publication of this Gospel of Judas. By the news conference was held by National Geographic, which had purchased the right to publish the book, to publish the Gospel of Judas, which had been discovered some years earlier, but came to public attention only in the early 2000s. National Geographic had asked me to help verify the antiquity of the book and to try of the Gospel of Judas before it got published, and to help establish its legitimacy as an ancient gospel, but also to try and understand how it fit into the ancient world of Christianity and how it fit in with other gospels and with other texts and how it fit in theologically with other things. And so I was able to see the manuscript in the original manuscript in outside of Geneva, in a town called Nyon on the shore of the lake of whatever, the Geneva Lake. I saw it and I was given permission to write a book about it. And so the deal was that those of us who were first studying it were basing what we read on a translation that was done by one of the members of the team. We couldn't really look at the Coptic because it was in a manuscript we didn't have access to. And many of us who first published on this, in fact, the entire National Geographic team was convinced that the Gospel of Judas was a Gnostic gospel, which is absolutely right. It is a Gnostic gospel. And we were all convinced that that Judas was portrayed as a hero figure. Judas Iscariot was being portrayed as a hero in the gospel. And we were all convinced of that. We all wrote about that. And after we published our stuff, other scholars got rather angry with us for not including them on the team as if we had a choice. And also, the one thing they disagreed with was, is Judas really a hero in this account? And some scholars took the opposite view, which is the kind of thing you expect within scholarship. Somebody stakes out a position, and then you write a book, you can take the opposite position. Because, you know, otherwise, if you take the same position, why are you writing a book? And so some scholars took the opposite position, that Judas Iscariot is portrayed as the bad guy in this text. And so has my position changed? I think they are absolutely wrong. Judas is not the bad guy in this text. I think we were somewhat wrong in thinking that he is a Gnostic. But I do think he's the good guy in the text. He is not one of the people who is going to be given eternal life as a Gnostic, but he's far above the other apostles in his knowledge and understanding of Jesus. And so he's kind of an intermediary figure, which is also very interesting. All right. So you can read my book there are a number of books about Judas Iscariot that are available now. All right. Next question. Do you find humor in any of the gospel stories? And if so, what are some of your favorite examples? Yes, I do find humor in some of the gospel stories. It is worth noting that Jesus never laughs in the New Testament. He laughs four times in the Gospel of Judas, and he laughs in other Gnostic texts, but he never laughs in the New Testament. He gets angry, but he doesn't laugh. But is there any humor there? I think there is humor there, and it's a little hard to know whether the humor goes back to Jesus or not, but I wouldn't be surprised. My old-time favorite is his saying that, why are you worried about the speck in your brother's eye when you've got a log in your eye? I mean, that's supposed to be funny. you got this piece of, you got the tree trunk in your eye, and you're worried about your brother having a little speck in his eye. What's wrong with you? And so I think that's supposed to be funny. Another one that I never really thought about until like just some months ago is Jesus' parable of the unforgiving slave. This is a parable found in Matthew chapter 18, verses 23 through 35. And the reason I hadn't thought about how funny it is because I don't think anybody really much thinks about how funny it is, because the measurement of money that is given in this parable is something we don't really think about. So this is the parable of the talents. It's a parable that involves talents. Talent is a weight of money. And in this parable, the deal is there's a slave owner who has slaves. And in the ancient world, in many ways, it was like what we think of in the antebellum South. In many ways, it was. There was a person who owned people who had to do his bidding, or they could be punished severely. So that's the same. But there were lots of other differences. It wasn't race-based, for example, or ethnicity-based. Most slaves were prisoners of war or their children. And so there are other reasons for the slavery. But also in the Roman world, slaves often could make money. Their masters would pay them money or loan them money, and they could engage in economic transactions on their own. In this parable, there's a master of slaves, and he's loaned money to one of them. And we're told that he's loaned him 10,000 talents. And talent is a weight of money. And the slave can't pay it back, and the master forgives him. And then the slave goes off to another slave to whom he's loaned just a little bit of money. And he won't forgive this other slave for the debt, even though his master just forgave him for a large debt. The master finds out and gets really ticked off and throws him in jail. He doesn't let him out until he pays the whole thing. And so the idea is that if you get forgiven, you need to forgive. Which is like the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us, kind of thing. But what I've never realized is just how significant this amount of money is that the slave allegedly owns. And so Jesus says that the slave owes the master 10,000 talents. And it finally occurred to me, that sure sounds like a lot of money. I wonder how much money that is. So I looked it up. a talent. So that's not an ability. It's a weight. It's a weight of silver or a weight of gold. So 1,000. So one talent was worth 6,000 denarii. Okay, well, what's a denarius worth? A denarius is what a day laborer makes in one day. So a denarius would be the average wage that a person would get in one day for doing, you know, a regular old job, you know, working a field or building something or whatever. So in North Carolina right now, I think the minimum wage is $7.25. So you put in an 8-hour day, for $7, so that's one denarius, that's $58. So a denarius is worth $58. But if a talent is worth 6,000 denarii, then one talent would be $348,000. $348,000. This slave owes his master 10,000 talents. In other words, just short of $3.5 billion. So this is Jesus at his hyperbolic best, where he said, this guy owed him $3.5 billion. And then like this other guy owed him $1,000, and he threw the guy in jail for owing him $1,000 after he'd just been forgiven $3.5 billion. And so it's the kind of thing you just don't notice unless you kind of look it up and start thinking about it. And so I think, I think that one's pretty funny. Okay. Next question. Who do you think was the first follower of Jesus actually to make the claim that Jesus had been resurrected? It's a very good question. In the New Testament, there are two leading options, and I think they are both possible options. The earliest account we have is the Apostle Paul, who, as you may know, never talked about Jesus' tomb being empty. I personally think Paul did think the tomb was empty, because he really does think that Jesus was physically raised from the dead. But he doesn't ever talk about an empty tomb. What he talks about is the people who first saw Jesus. And he says that the first to see Jesus after the resurrection was Cephas, or Peter. In the Gospels, it is the women, especially Mary Magdalene, who first see Jesus. They go to the tomb. They see it empty. There, in different gospels, there are different numbers and different names of women who go, but Mary Magdalene is the constant. And in the Gospel of John, she's explicitly the first one to see Jesus. I think that even if there was an empty tomb, which I'm not sure of, but even if there was an empty tomb, I don't think that would lead anybody to believe Jesus was raised from the dead. If somebody knew where Jesus was buried and they go there and he's not in the tomb, they'd probably think that somebody's stolen the body or they're in the wrong tomb. Or, you know, they wouldn't think, oh, he's been raised from the dead. But if Jesus has been executed and then he appears to people, that would, I think, more likely make somebody think that he'd been raised from the dead if they were sure he was already dead, and they were. It is interesting that in the New Testament, the empty tomb never leads to faith. When people find the tomb empty, they're puzzled by it and they can't figure it out. It doesn't lead to faith. The one thing that leads to faith is Jesus' appearances. So I think probably historically, there were disciples who claimed they saw Jesus alive again afterwards. The two leading candidates in the New Testament are his closest male disciple, Peter, and a person who may well have been his closest female follower, not one of the 12, but Mary Magdalene. I think that's possible. I don't know which would have been first. Don't know. In John's gospel, for example, and actually, well, I guess elsewhere in the gospels, Mary informs Peter and the others. And that's why in early Christianity, sometimes Mary Magdalene was called an apostle to the apostles. She's the one who proclaimed Jesus' resurrection to others, to the apostles. So I think that's possible. I think that several people thought they saw Jesus alive after his death. If you're a Christian, you'd say, well, they did see him. If you're not a Christian, you'd say, well, they thought they saw him. They had a vision or a dream, or they mistaken identity. Something made them think they saw Jesus alive afterwards, and that's what began the belief in his resurrection. I suspect it's one of those two. Okay, next question. This one asks me, do you know of any scholars that have made the opposite journey that you made, from atheist to faithful, the more they studied the history of the religion? Okay, that's a good question. So I went from being a committed, very committed Bible-believing Christian to being now an atheist. And so the person's asking, do I know anybody who went kind of the opposite way? And there are certainly lots of stories of people who've gone the other direction. And you probably are familiar with people, some of them fairly famous, who you started out as atheists, but then the more they studied, they came to think Jesus really was raised from the dead, or Jesus really is the Son of God. They came to be believers. There are lots of stories like that. I don't personally know anybody like that. I don't think I know of any biblical scholar like that. I know people who became apologists, who started out as non-believers, or who became theologians maybe, but in terms of like somebody who's a, you know, technically a Bible scholar, I don't think I know of anybody quite like that. Some of you may know someone like that. The reality is, though, I don't know. I'm trying to think if I know anybody who took the same journey I took. I'm not sure I do, going from very conservative Christian to being atheist. I know biblical scholars who are atheists, and I know a lot of biblical scholars that went on a faith journey because of their biblical scholarship, but almost none of them that I can think of became atheists. What typically happens, what happens a lot, is that you'll have somebody who's very invested in the Bible as a young person. They study the Bible, they become convinced the Bible is the infallible Word of God, but then they go to graduate school and they start reading it in Greek or in Hebrew and or Hebrew, and they start reading scholarship and they start realizing, oh my God, I was wrong. There are mistakes here. What almost always happens in that case is they become a more mainline Christian. And they become somebody who absolutely believes in God and believes in Christ, but realizes that the Bible is a very human book. Even if they think that in some way God speaks through the Bible, God may speak through the Bible, but it still has human problems because it is written by humans. I know lots and lots of scholars like that. Almost all my scholarly friends are like that, but they're still Christian. The idea of becoming an atheist, just many of you know this, but I became an atheist not because of the scholarship. I became an atheist because of wrestling with the problems of evil and suffering in the world, not related to my analysis of the Gospels or my study of Paul or anything like that. And so it isn't necessarily kind of a natural journey that a biblical scholar would take toward atheism. It just, it happened in my case for other reasons. Okay. Right. Next question. Where did my next question go? Okay. Next question. Were the writers of the Gospels Jews? Simple question. Complicated answer. We don't know. I guess that's easy. I'll tell you a common view. A common view is that Matthew was definitely a Jew. I'd say that almost everybody agrees that Luke was a Gentile. And I'd say Mark and John are debated. The thing about Mark is that Mark doesn't seem to know a lot about Judaism, and he says things about Judaism that aren't true. When he says, for example, is it chapter 6, where he talks about the washing of hands, I think, 6, 7, where the Pharisees are upset because the disciples don't wash their hands before they eat, because that's, and it doesn't make sense in the ancient world because most people didn't wash their hands, and people didn't know about germs. They may have washed their hands because they didn't want to eat with mud on their fingers, but there wasn't like this ritual of washing hands the way there is for people in America today. And for most people in America, it's not a religious ritual. It's just because we know about germs. And so we wash our hands. In the ancient world, they didn't know about germs. And so washing hands, if it happened, was a religious ritual. And Mark says that that the Pharisees insisted that people wash their hands before they eat, as do all the Jews. Well, that's not true in the ancient world. We know it. That's not true. But Mark seems to think it's true. And so does that suggest he wasn't Jewish? Well, maybe. Or maybe he just, maybe his kind of Judaism knows all about it. But I think there's little to suggest that Mark was Jewish. And I also don't think John was Jewish myself. One reason for thinking so is this kind of vehement opposition to Jews in the Gospel of John, where when Jesus' enemies in John, sometimes they're called the Pharisees, but a lot of times they're just called the Jews. Jesus' enemies are the Jews, as if he's not a Jew. And moreover, sometimes when Jesus talks to them, he says very nasty things to the Jews, one of which in chapter 7 is where Jesus says that they're not descendants of David, of Abraham. He says, Abraham's not your father. He says that their father is the devil. So Satan is the father of the Jews. What? Wow. Now, it is possible, of course, for a Jew to be anti-Jewish. I mean, it's possible in the modern world for Jews to be anti-Semitic. In my classes last week, I was trying to explain to my students the difference between anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. Anti-Judaism, to put it in simple terms, it took me a while to unpack this in my class, but in simple terms, being anti-Jewish means you're opposed to the Jewish religion and the people who practice it. Anti-Semitism is opposition to Jews, whatever their religion is. We don't have that kind of thing where somebody who is Jewish is just inferior and worthy of hatred and even destruction. You don't have that until the 19th century, when scholars started developing anthropological theories of race, where there are these races of the human races, and you can kind of stack them up in terms of their quality. You know, you get Caucasians, and you get Mongoloid, you get Negroid, and you come up with these things, and you characterize them, and it isn't just like the color of the skin or, you know, structure of the skeleton. It's also like mental capacity, and it's quality of thinking and quality of morals, and you come up with these things. And so the Nazis ran with that one. So that anybody who was born in a Jewish line was Jewish. And it didn't matter if the person was Roman Catholic and parents had been Roman Catholic. If their grandparents had been Jewish, they're Jewish, and they go to the camps as much as anyone else, even though like they've got nothing to do with Judaism. Well, that's anti-Semitism, opposition to Jews as inferior because they're from the ethnicity of, you know, ethnic, from the bloodline, from Jewish bloodlines, whereas anti-Judaism is opposition to Jews and Judaism for the religion, is the way I define it. And the Gospel of John is definitely anti-Jewish that way. It's anti-Jewish, but it's not opposed to Jews for because of bloodlines or something. So anyway, I do think that the Gospel of John is anti-Jewish. Jesus, sometimes when he's talking to his Jewish opponents, says, in your law, it says, what Jew would say in your law to other Jews? You know, he'd say, well, in our law, and then correct them about some misreading. So I think the only Jewish author that I'm pretty sure about is Matthew. I certainly don't think Luke was. I actually don't think Mark was either. And I lean toward thinking John couldn't have been either. Okay, next question. Do you believe Jesus was born in Bethlehem or Nazareth? Well, I don't know where he was born, but I certainly don't think he was born in Bethlehem. The only two accounts of that are Matthew and Luke, and they completely disagree with each other about how it happened. They both want him born in Bethlehem, and they both get him born in Bethlehem, but they get him born in Bethlehem in contradictory ways. So I don't think he could trust that, especially because Matthew tells us he had to be born in Bethlehem because the book of Micah, chapter 5, verse 2, says that's where the Savior is going to come from. So Matthew has to get him born in Bethlehem, and he does, and so does Luke. He comes from Nazareth. All the gospel writers agree that he came from Nazareth. Even Mark and John. And so I assume that he was born in Nazareth. You know, he might have been born somewhere else and grew up in Nazareth. Maybe, I don't know, seems unlikely. My guess is that he was born in Nazareth. It's interesting that in the, over the last 30 or 40 years, even major Roman Catholic biblical scholars have sometimes argued he was probably born in Nazareth. This multi-volume book, the kind of the biggest book probably ever written about Jesus, multi-volume, by John Meyer, M-E-I-E-R, who is an ordained Catholic priest, but he was a very, very fine biblical scholar who taught at Notre Dame. He ended up arguing in his book, the book is called A Marginal Jew, multi-volume work on Jesus. He ended up arguing that Jesus probably was born in Nazareth. Okay, next question. Are you aware of any platforms or services where biblical scholars offer freelance consulting or review services for research purposes or for research proposals? Alternatively, do you have any recommendations for how I might find suitable experts willing to provide paid feedback? Well, if you're willing to pay, I suppose you can find experts anywhere. So lots of people tell you they're experts, or you could probably just go online and find some biblical scholar someplace and just ask them, would you be willing to have a paid consultation with me? I myself do consultations on my website, barterman.com. I don't do very many of them by choice, but it's a paid service. I've thought about expanding it, because I've thought about like seeing if I could round up other people to do this who would maybe charge less than I do. So people would, because, just kind of have a range, what do you want? You know, it depends really what you want. If you want hardcore expertise of somebody who's really an expert, obviously that's different from if you want somebody to fact check for you. You know, there are lots of people who could do that. And I'm thinking about expanding my consultation thing. But we have right now for the Biblical Studies Academy is part of that whole, it's not part of the consultation thing, but the consultation thing is part of the Biblical Studies Academy and the online courses that we do and the podcast. All of that is arranged under a rubric that we've actually changed the name of recently. It's Critical Paths in Religion, we're calling it. But it's a It's a, but if you just look up my website, you'll bartherman.com, you'll see all these options. And if that's not the kind of thing you're looking for, really, I would just suggest if you read a book by somebody that you're interested in, just write them and ask if they'd be willing to do a paid consultation. Might be the easiest thing. Biblical scholars rarely get asked that, and I think, you know, a lot of people would be willing to. Okay, next. When people talk about the Ten Commandments, why do they never talk about the re-chiseled tablets in Exodus 34? The only chapter that explicitly calls the words on the tablet the Ten Commandments. Good question. So, you may know or you may not know that there are actually three passages that can legitimately be called passages that give the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament. All three are in the Torah, as you would expect. The first one that appears, if you're reading through the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, first one you come to is Exodus chapter 20. This is the usual place that people turn to for the Ten Commandments. This is what happens at this point is Moses has been empowered by God to lead the children of Israel out of their slavery in Egypt. They've crossed the Sea of Reeds, and God has performed a miracle, killed the entire Egyptian army, wiped them all out, saved the people of Israel. Moses has now led them on to Mount Sinai, and he goes up on Mount Sinai, and God gives him the Ten Commandments. This is the very beginning of the law, the Jews. The Ten Commandments begin the law, and after the Ten Commandments are given in chapter 20 of Exodus, then there's a whole string of laws through the rest of Exodus, through all of Leviticus, for Numbers, chapters 1 through 20. So there are, you know, there are large chunks of the Torah, the Hebrew, the Pentateuch, that give the law. But the Ten Commandments are found in the first bit. And that's the first place you find it. They're not called the Ten Commandments there. It's just that God makes commandments to Moses, and he writes them on clay tablets, two clay tablets. And then in the story, let me say something about those Ten Commandments. Even though the passage doesn't call them the Ten Commandments, they're always numbered as 10. But the intriguing thing is that different religious groups number the 10 differently. The way it's the Ten Commandments begin, the first in the in traditional Jewish ranking is when God says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt." And most Christians say that ain't a commandment, but that is the first one in Jewish reckoning. Protestants and Catholics, and Greek Orthodox, order the 10 differently. So if you actually count up all of the ones that different groups come up with as commandments, there are 12 of them, but they all agree that there are 10 of them, even though the passage doesn't say there are 10 of them. Why do they say there are 10 of them? It's because of the next occurrence of a list that are commandments in Exodus chapter 34. In Exodus 34, back at the beginning in Exodus 20, Moses has these two tablets, the two tablets of the law, where these commandments are written on clay tablets. And Moses carries them down the mountain. He's been up on the mountain for 40 days with God, and he brings down these 10 commandments. And when he comes to the foot of the mountain, he sees that the children of Israel are committing idolatry. They've formed a golden calf and are worshiping this golden calf as the God who brought them out of Egypt. And so that is idolatry, making an image of Yahweh, and Moses realizes they've broken the Ten Commandments before they've been given them. That's how bad it is. Even before they get them, they've broken them. And he, in anger, throws the tablets down, the clay tablets down, and smashes them to smithereens. God calls him back up And he goes back up. In chapter 34, we're told that God rewrites the commandments. And this time they are called the Ten Commandments. They're kind of called the Ten Commandments. They're called the Decalogue, the Ten Words. Decalogue is the Greek translation of it. In Hebrew, it's the Ten Words. And the Ten Words then are the go under the name, the Ten Commandments. Okay, so God rewrites them. The problem is, Exodus 34 then lists these commandments, and they're not the Ten Commandments. There are other kinds of commandments, like kill everybody in the land when you get into there, you know? And I mean, there are other laws that God's giving people, but they're called the Ten Words. And it's not just that they're different from the 10 in Exodus 20. There definitely are not 10 in Exodus 34. You could number them different ways, but they're way more than 10. And yet they're called the 10 words. So that's very strange. So the strangeness continues, but it doesn't get worse when you get to Deuteronomy chapter 5. The name Deuteronomy is the fifth book of the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The word Deuteronomy, again, it comes from the Greek. It means the second law. The second law. It's actually not the second law. It's a re-summary of the first law that God gave Moses, as found in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. What ends up happening is the children of Israel they've been given the law in the book of Exodus and Leviticus and in Numbers, and then they're told to go to the promised land and to conquer it. But they doubt that they're going to be able to, and because of their doubt, God gets ticked off at them and tells them they're not going to get in. They've got to stay in the wilderness for 40 years, so that entire generation dies out. And the generation that came out of the Exodus, out of Egypt, they don't get the promised land because of their doubt. Their children and grandchildren will go in. And there are only a couple of people, Joshua, the leader of the Jewish troops, and the successor of Moses, Joshua, and a man named Caleb, who are from the first generation who get to go in. So Numbers deals with the 40 years that they're in the wilderness, mainly at a particular site called Barnish, Kadesh Barnea, which is like a big oasis. It's got to be really big. It had to be bigger than it really is, because in the book of Numbers, we're told that the people who left Egypt, just the men, the soldier age men, so I don't know what that is, maybe 18 years old, 16 years old, 18, up through, you know, to the time they're too old to serve in the army anymore, that number of men were 630,000 that left Egypt. And that's not counting the women and children or the old geezers, men. So whatever that is, 2 or 3 million people left Egypt. By the way, there's no record of that. The Egyptians, like, don't mention that. And the Pharaoh, who allegedly was killed in the Red Sea, lived on for many years later, because we still have his mummy. You can see his mummy, Ramses II, if you go to Egypt, visit Egypt, Cairo. Kadesh Barnea had to be a big place, because if there are 2 million people there, need a lot of water for that. And there's no, by the way, they've dug up Kadesh Barnea. There's no trace of anybody having been there like that. But apart from all that, when Moses, at the end of the 40 years, the time's up, and he can now go back in, he can take the people into the promised land, but God's not going to let him in either. So Joshua's going to go in. Moses has to give them the law the second time. So Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law, where Moses gives the law a second time to the generation now that is subsequent to the one he gave the law to in the first place. So he summarizes the law in the book of Deuteronomy. That's the setting of it. The reality is that Deuteronomy comes from a different source. Whoever wrote Deuteronomy did not write Exodus. And so this is a different account of what the law was, But in the Pentateuch, it's set up as Moses giving it a second time. And there are differences, of course, between the way Deuteronomy does it and the way Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers does it in terms of the law. But in Deuteronomy chapter 5, there's another account of the Ten Commandments. This one is very close to Exodus 20, with a few minor changes that some people think are important, but there are a few minor changes. All right, so back to the question. The question is, why doesn't anybody talk about Exodus 34 when you're talking about the law? And I think it's because most people don't know about it. But also, I think it's because it's confusing, because that is where they're called, the 10 words, but there aren't 10 of them, and they're not the 10 that everybody knows about. This is all a problem of sources with the Pentateuch. Scholars especially since the 19th century, have realized that the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, are made up of a variety of sources that were independently written of one another that have been spliced together with transitions provided between them. And that's why you get two different creation accounts in Genesis 1 and 2. And it's why you have different accounts of the giving of the law, etc., because they're different sources. Okay, next question. Was there something specific going on in the era around 70 to 85 of the Common Era that the Gospels were written then? Luke hints at earlier Gospels. Did they need to be corrected or amended as the church became more Gentile than Jewish? Okay, yeah, well, good question. So I would say that Luke doesn't hint at earlier Gospels. He explicitly comes out and says that there were other Gospels floating around. It's Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. Luke is quite explicit. The very beginning of the account says that there have been many people, who have undertaken to write an account of the things that have been accomplished among us. And he's obviously going to be talking about the words and deeds of Jesus. But he says many people have done that. He goes on to say that, but I who have followed all these things closely, where the word might be better at, translated, I who followed all these things accurately, am now going to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the truth of the things that have happened. So Luke, whoever he is, he doesn't call himself Luke. He doesn't identify himself. He's writing for, allegedly, a person named Theophilus, and he indicates that there have been lots of Gospels written before this, but he says he's followed things accurately, and he's going to write an orderly account. That sure looks like he's saying that the other accounts were not entirely accurate and they didn't quite have the right order of things. They weren't in order. But now he's going to do it. That's especially interesting given the fact that scholars are almost unanimously convinced that Luke had as one of his sources the Gospel of Mark, that he changes significantly. Is he saying that Mark is not an accurate or orderly gospel? Kind of looks like it. Why did gospels start showing up when they did, and did some of them have to be amended and corrected? I assume that anybody who knows of a gospel and writes his own gospel thinks that he's probably going to do a better job. And especially if he uses an account that he changes. Like he copies it and places word for word, but then he'll change something. He'll add a story. He'll alter a story. He'll completely transform a story. It's probably because he thinks he has a better information or a better idea. Luke did that. Matthew did that with Mark as well. So I do think that probably they thought they had to be, if not corrected, at least supplemented, augmented, but also changed in some ways. But it's hard to imagine changing a source if you think that the source is perfectly fine the way it is, maybe, but usually it's because you think you could say it better. Why does it start in the year 70? Now, it doesn't just stop in the year 85, I'll say that. Probably the Gospel of John was written in the 90s, usually thought, and there continue to be Gospels written after that. We don't have exact dates for any of the Gospels. It's usually thought that the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Thomas maybe were written around the year 120, and we have Gospels that continue to be written for centuries after that. If you're interested in those other gospels, I was mentioning the narrative of Joseph of Arimathea earlier is one of these other gospels that somebody wrote. It's a fictional account. It's not at all clear that the author wanted you to think that it was fiction. But it's clearly highly legendary, whatever the author wanted you to think. But books like that are being written centuries later. So there never was kind of an end to it. It's just that the Gospels that got included in the New Testament were the four that people generally thought were the authoritative ones. Even though Luke tells us they're not the only early ones. We don't know if later times they knew many of these earlier ones or not. Probably not. We don't hear much about them, anything about them really. But why 70? Why did Gospels start being written in the year 70? Why not, for example, in their 40 or 50? There's no definitive answer to this. People will have different answers, but I think there are several things to consider. One is, it does appear that the earliest Christians, starting with our first author, Paul, but I think going all the way back, I think the earliest Christians thought that the end was coming soon. That's what Jesus said. I think they believed him. And if the end is coming very soon, you know, like it's going to be next month sometime, there's no reason to write a gospel. You should be out there trying to convert people. You shouldn't be out there writing gospels for future generations. And so I think people didn't see any reason probably to write gospels until it looked like we're here for the long haul. Once you start realizing it's going to be a while yet, you might need gospels. You might need gospels to educate people in your church. You might need gospels to correct false views about Jesus. There are reasons to write gospels, and probably it starts becoming more acute when it looks like the end is not coming right away. Second thing to say, there probably were not very many literate people before the year 70 in the Christian communities. There were some. Obviously, there were people in Paul's churches who could read. But being able to read in the ancient world is not the same thing as knowing how to write. And knowing how to write letters and how to copy letters isn't the same thing as knowing how to compose. And knowing how to compose is not the same thing as being able to compose with correct grammar. And being know how to write with correct grammar isn't the same as knowing how to write a really powerful narrative. These four Gospels are powerful narratives. They're not written by average folk, and there were not too many people who were trained at that level of literacy in the Christian churches in the first several decades. So I don't know how many people could actually produce something like this. And so that's another consideration. There's no need to, because the end's coming soon, and not many people could write anyway. Another issue is that around the year 70s, when everybody would start realizing that, yeah, you know, the apostles are all dead now, or they're going to be dead soon. And if we want records of what they said, we better write them down because, while we still have some memories of this. And so maybe because the first generation had virtually all died off by this time, they think, okay, we got to start writing. Another thing, though, might be connected with the year 70 itself. The year 70 is the year that the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. And it may be, we have pretty good indications that there were people, Christians, who thought that the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70, when the Romans wiped it out and destroyed the temple, that that's what Jesus had predicted as the beginning of the end. You get suggestions of that in Mark 13, in Matthew chapters 24 and 25, Luke 21, that people thought that this is the coming of the end, the beginning of the end. If they thought that, but they think, well, it started and we need to get the word out there more broadly. Or maybe they're thinking, look, it was supposed to happen then, like if that was going to be it. And then the next day, the rest was going to happen. It didn't happen the next day. You know, a year or two later, they might start thinking, you know, it didn't happen. We better write a gospel because it's more kind of a further argument about it possibly being for the long haul. So we don't know exactly, but those are some of the reasons that could be adduced. Okay, next question. My question is about the intertextuality between Paul's writings and our gospels. I know this person says that Paul wrote before the first gospel was written. Did his writings influence how the gospel writers wrote their texts? Were the gospel writers even aware of Paul's writings? Okay, so that's a complicated question, and there is a good bit of dispute about it among scholars. There are scholars, I'd say probably a growing number of scholars, who are more and more convinced that the gospel writers knew the writings of Paul. I think that there's a tendency that way because generally within the field of biblical studies, there tends to be a lowering of the bar of evidence now than there used to be. There used to be kind of a high bar to cross over before you'd say one author knew another author. You look for really some substantial evidence for that. Like there's substantial evidence that Matthew used the Gospel of Mark. There are, he tells 96% of Mark is in Matthew. The sequence of the stories is very often the same, and sometimes it's word for word the same. I mean, how does that happen? Somebody's copying somebody. You don't have that with lots of other things, but scholars are becoming more and more inclined to think that you don't need that much evidence. You just need like some evidence. And so that's why people are getting rid of Q now, because, well, you know, you've got some similarities. It's why you get rid of, why you think John copied the synoptics, because, well, they've got some similarities. And so it's not as high of a demand of proof. And, you know, maybe that's right. But when it comes to the Gospels and Paul, the same thing's in play. That that I think more people are thinking that the Gospels knew Paul. I don't think there's good evidence of it. And the evidence that people cite doesn't strike me as very, very significant for the gospel writers actually knowing the letters of Paul. The first thing I'll say is, what does that even mean? I guess that's a question, not a statement. What does it even mean that the gospel writers knew the writings of Paul? What people almost invariably mean is that the gospel writers had the seven letters that we know about. And I don't think people stop enough to think about what that really entails, because Paul must have written hundreds and hundreds of letters. He had over 30 congregations. He ministered for over 30 years. He wrote multiple letters to multiple congregations. I mean, how many letters did he write? Even if he writes just two of his 30 congregations, say he has 30 congregations, he writes them each, you know, twice a year. Well, that's 60 times 30 years. Do the math. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of letters. We have seven. So what's the likelihood that Matthew happens to have our seven? Why would he have our seven? Why not some other seven? I mean, I don't see the logic of it. If you say, well, these are the only seven important ones, why would you say that? Well, they're the ones in the Bible. Yeah, well, later people thought they had these and they kept them, but it doesn't mean. So there's that. The other thing is, what would make you think so? Mark especially does have a theology that is closely related to Paul's, but the theology is a theology that was widespread, especially that Jesus had to die for the sins of the world and that his death brought an atonement and things like that, that I think a lot of churches were saying. Paul may have influenced these churches, but these ideas are ones that you can find throughout early Christianity. You don't have to read Paul to get that. So Paul may have influenced these authors. Matthew may be writing against Paul. Matthew thinks that Matthew thinks that a person has to keep the law of the Jews to be a follower of Jesus. Matthew's Jesus insists that you have to keep the law even better than the scribes and the Pharisees, that in fact you have to follow the Pharisees' interpretation of the law. Matthew chapter 23, verse 2. A verse that almost everybody skips over because they can't believe he's saying this, but he does say it. For Matthew, you have to not just keep the law, but better than the Pharisees, and you have to actually keep the laws of the Pharisees. Paul doesn't think that. Oh my God, he thinks just the opposite. And Matthew's certainly writing later than Paul. So maybe that Matthew's reacting to Paul, but it doesn't mean he's read his letters. He may be reacting to a view that's become very widespread. Partly because of Paul, but partly because other people have said something similar. So my view is that you need to have a high burden of proof, and it's just not there. I think Paul certainly influenced things, but I think that one problem is we think of Paul as the most important person in Christianity after Jesus, and we are, we're right, historically. But in his day, what evidence is there that Paul was hugely influential? Even in Paul's own letters, he indicates that he, I mean, he talks more about his enemies than his friends among the churches, where people just disagree with him all over the place. So is he really kind of determining the whole shooting match? I don't think so. Okay, I've got one other question I'm going to do quickly. We could spend a long time on it. It's my last question. I understand the terms Messiah or Son of Man referring to Jesus come from Judaism. However, it seems to me that the phrase Son of God is foreign to Judaism. Is this a Greco-Roman concept that was joined in the Messianic tradition early in Christianity or what? Two things to say. Son of God is not foreign to the Old Testament or to Judaism. It's a common term. It gets used in the Old Testament, for example, of different beings. A son of God in the Old Testament is some kind of living being that manifests or implements God's will on earth. And so the king of Israel is called the Son of God because he's the conduit through which God communicates and works his will. There are angels called the sons of God because they're the ones who implement God's will on earth. The nation of Israel is called the Son of God. Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. And so Son of God is not alien to Judaism, and it comes out of the Old Testament as somebody who manifests God's will on earth, and that's how early Christians understood Jesus, someone in a particularly close relationship with God who did God's will on earth and spoke God's will on earth. So there's that. It's also true, though, that it can be found, Son of God can be found in the Greek and Roman worlds. And it's true that there are aspects of the Greco-Roman sons of God that you can find in the stories of Jesus. You have sons of God in the Greek and Roman worlds who can do miracles, who are miraculously born of the union of a divine being and a human being, who can heal the sick, cast out demons, control the weather, raise the dead. At the end of their life, they're taken up to heaven. So you get that idea about sons of God in the Greek and Roman worlds. It is true, though, that within Christianity, they meld these views, the Hebrew Bible view, the Greek and Roman view, but also the view of the Messiah as the one who'll be the future king of Israel, the great and powerful ruler. For Christians, that is Jesus, not in his life, but in his second coming, that he will be the Messiah when he arrives, and that he's ruling as king now, so he already is the Messiah, but he wasn't the Messiah yet in his lifetime. So I don't think that it's either Greco-Roman or Jewish. I think it's both. But I think it principally started out within the Jewish community as people came to believe that Jesus was the future Messiah who was the one close to God who manifested his will. And so he was the Son of God. Okay, well, I got through half of the questions. And so I consider that a victory. So thank you for coming to this. And thank you for listening. If you're not here with me live, feel free to ask questions next time. Again, try to keep them short and to the point, and I will try to answer them as well as I can. I really appreciate all of you being gold members on the blog. If there are things we can do to improve your experience, let me know. We are very much trying to grow the blog, and we're going to start big time when we have the new implementation of the blog itself. The platform itself is being modified now. It's a very big undertaking that we are taking on. And once that happens, we're going to start growing significantly. But you can really help a lot if you just tell your family and friends about the blog. And if they have any interest in this kind of stuff, just tell them and try them to try it out. Okay. So anyway, thanks so much for being at the gold level, and I look forward to seeing you next time.